Welcome to Strategy Talk, where the contributors to strategypage.com discuss news as history and give you a unique view of events around the world. I'm Dan Masterson, publisher of strategypage.com, your host. We'll be talking to Al Nofi, military historian and author. Al compiles and writes our popular CIC section on the site. Hi, Al. How are you doing today?
Very good. Very good. Beautiful day.
Yep. And for those that don't know, Al lives in Texas and has a lot of Texas connections and has written a book called The Alamo and the Texas War for Independence. So how did the whole Texas War for Independence get started? What was the American connection in that, Al?
Oddly, it begins with the Spanish, even before Mexican independence, began to look around for settlers in the Texas region. So they were giving out land grants, and then, of course, Napoleon invades Spain in 1808, and there's a revolution in Spain which installs a very liberal government. So now there's a revolution in Mexico for independence, which is being fought by a royalist army which is not very happy with what's going on in Spain. So it gets very confusing, of course. And the Mexican nationalists actually recruited people in the U.S. They recruited an army in the southern U.S. in 1813 to campaign in Texas, and these guys went out and got their butts kicked somewhat south of San Antonio, and most of them were murdered by the Spanish army, one of whose officers was the infamous Santana, then only a junior officer. So finally what happens is 1821, the revolution is still going on in Mexico, and in 1821 there's a revolution in Spain which installs a liberal government. So suddenly the royal army, which is fighting against the liberal revolutionaries in Spain, discovers that there's liberal revolutionaries in Madrid too. So what they decide to do is throw in with the revolution, and they declare the one of the principal generals, royalist generals, the Emperor of Mexico. Well, that lasts a couple of years, of course, and then the Republic comes in. Meanwhile, they're still honoring and handing out land grants. And Texas is at the butt end of Mexico, you know, for those days. So people from the U.S. are coming in. People from other countries are coming in as well, in fact. And so you get this American colony in Mexico, and they tend to be slave owners. Now, much is made of the fact that the Mexican Constitution abolished slavery, which is nice on paper, but actually in practice, of course, they hadn't. They continued to have peonage. In fact, peonage would not be abolished in Mexico until almost the 20th century. They continued to have bond service and prison sentences to servitude for many generations. So the Texans who moved, the Americans who moved to Texas with their slaves, basically just, you know, had the slave make an X where it says 99-year indenture. And that's legal under Mexican law, apparently. There are other restrictions which are not, you know, that important. They're supposed to learn Spanish, which the early ones actually do, and they're supposed to convert to Catholicism, which again the early ones actually do. That's how Sam Houston ends up with becoming a Catholic. And so this goes on and on. Now, meanwhile, the real problem in Mexico is the inability to establish a stable government. And the empire lasts about a year and is overthrown by Santa Anna, who had been made a brigadier general by the emperor. And a republic is installed, and then the republic has a few problems, and somebody else comes in. And there's basically a series of coups. Memorizing the presidency of the United States is getting difficult with 44. Memorizing the presidents of Mexico is not only difficult, but embarrassing. because there's some real thugs in there. In 1824, a liberal constitution is established in Mexico, and it is championed by Santana, close with him. He's a wonderful guy, actually. He's quite easy. No more close than most Mexican political leaders, but much more successful at it. By this time, Texas has attracted, in the 1820s, Texas has attracted a great many American settlers. And there are just cultural problems. Mexico is a kind of a top-down political system. The Texans are coming, from the U.S. mostly, and they're used to a kind of bottom-up political system. Santana takes over, ostensibly in a liberal coup, and then establishes himself as just as much a thug president as several of his predecessors, some of whom are actually not thugs, but not capable of being thuggish when they had to be. And so you get this basically a showdown between the American settlers and the Mexicans. And the Americans actually were working quite closely with a lot of Mexican liberals. Texas wasn't the only place to have an insurrection. Texas just happened to have good fortune to border on the U.S. from which it could draw strength, and the fact that there were American settlers there and the U.S. was feeling its oats helped a great deal. Now, there actually wasn't any U.S. government collusion in it. In fact, when Texas finally achieves independence, Andrew Jackson is adamantly opposed to annexing Texas. And that doesn't happen for another, practically another decade. Quite a different image of Jackson than is normally found. So anyway, the Texan settlers tend to be anarchic. And this is how we end up with the Alamo. They take over very quickly after a couple of showdown incidents. And that's partly because there's very few Mexican troops in Texas. They seize the Alamo in the fall of 1835. And parole the Mexican troops that are there and let them go on their way. Now, this is part of it's kind of a legalistic perspective they have, too. In other words, if they behave like legal authorities, the Mexicans will behave in the same way. Well, that wasn't going to work because insurrection is punished than war. If I'm captured in a war, well, I'm a prisoner of war. I'm captured in an insurrection, I'm just a thief, a pirate or something, and they'll shoot me. So you have these wonderful characters, meanwhile, flocking to Mexico to this over the few years. Guys like Travis and Bowie and of course, Sam Houston. And they create an army. Now, meanwhile, the Mexicans, of course... Having stomped out several rebellions down further south, Santana finally gets an army together and marches. That guy's really a very talented organizer, except that his ego keeps getting in the way, and he doesn't focus on the task at hand. He's very careless in some detail, but he's able to create armies very quickly, very efficiently. I mean, sometimes they have to drag the guys in with chains, but. Once you're in, you kind of socialize very quickly. So he marches north, and the Texans are forming an army, and volunteers are pouring in from the U.S. And there's basically these two outposts.
Now, what attracted the volunteers from the U.S.? Why did they pour in?
Oh, land, free land.
Okay, so it was all about land then?
It was all about land, yeah.
Okay.
I mean, the Mexicans and the Spanish first, and then the Mexican government... We had offered land for settlers, so many acres for every member of your family, including your slaves. I mean, your indentured servants, of course, they were no longer slaves. And so the Mexican Republic, I'm sorry, the Texas Republic basically did the same thing. In the end, about 3,500 people were awarded land by the Republic of Texas. And if you look at the statistics, it's rather interesting. By about 1835, American settlers in Texas, English-speaking settlers in Texas, outnumbered the Mexicans considerably. And if if you look at the 3,500 or so people granted land, about 10% of them have Spanish names. And that was roughly the ratio of population. So the representation of Mexican Texan in the revolutionary ranks was about that, the same as their proportion in the ranks of the in the population. And there were prominent Mexican members of the revolutionary movement, Zavala, for example, and of course, Seguin. So anyway, these volunteers coming down, and you're getting guys who are, you're sending guys down to basically the frontier with Mexico. And the frontier is pretty wide. I mean, San Antonio marks like the southern edge of settlement in Texas, and you got a long way to go before you cross, the Rio Grande and into Mexico before you get settled area again. Because it's basically just a big desert down there. I mean, if you go through there today, you come across repeated bridges over creeks and whatnot that aren't there, except in the rainy season.
Right. It's just terribly flat too.
Yeah, and it's very flat. In fact, if you drive from San Antonio to the coast, you're basically driving on sea bottom. Yeah. And if the sea were to rise just a couple of meters, you know, it would be sea bottom again. There's very few hills almost so. So you have at Goliad, you have an actual fortress. It's a nice little fort, you know, with bastions and stuff. And at the Alamo, basically you have a mission that had been built about a century, a little more than a century earlier, about 125 years earlier, to convert the Indians. The Indians proved very intractable, so it was converted into a cavalry post, you know, for the Mexican, well, the Spanish frontier guard. And it worked pretty well, against Indians. If you go to San Antonio today, what you see is only a fraction of the structure. If you go about 125 miles west of San Antonio on Highway 90, you can see the movie set, which is about three-quarters scale, but it actually has the walls and whatnot, sort of gives you a better notion of what it was like. It was basically just a walled monastery. And, good enough to beat off Indians, but not good enough to beat off anybody else. Unfortunately, what in Goliad was this guy named Fannin, who, despite having some military credentials, built of stone and whatnot that was designed to resist artillery. And if he had the guts to hold it, he might have held out considerably longer than the Alamo held out. At the Alamo, heck, you probably could have broken into the place with a pickaxe. I mean, that's, because it was just adobe. But it was sort of fortified, and on paper you probably could have, needed about 500 guys. And there's this William Barrett Travis, who's in there with, nobody actually knows how many guys, since no rolls were kept. There's a list of approximately 190 guys who are believed to have been killed in the Alamo, but it's not clear how many were there that managed to escape successfully, or not successfully. I mean, wandered off and then got killed by a Mexican cavalry patrol 3 days later and left to rot on the prairie, So anyway, Travis is basically a fanatic on holding this place, despite the fact that the Texas provisional government basically saying, abandon it. We have too many guys there that we can use. Santana marches up with his little army, and they invest the place. They haven't got their artillery up yet, so it takes a few days. And finally they storm the place and basically kill everybody, capture a few people, kill them. And then, of course, there's the great controversy. It was Davy Crockett, one of the people captured. And there are some people who argue that Davy couldn't possibly, he had to go down fighting the way he did in the Disney picture. Although there is a much older tradition than the Disney picture that he didn't go down fighting, and parallel tradition. And it really doesn't matter, since by all accounts the guys that were captured and murdered died well. So what difference does it make? This certainly didn't make a difference to Davy. Meanwhile. In back in the rest of Texas, there are people who are basically just saying, hey, let's get some of the boys and go down there and, you know, and Sam Houston is basically trying to hold things down, because what he's trying to do is get a government organized. These guys were doing things sort of by the seat of their pants, you know, sort of like...
So a lot of freelancers.
Garland.
Yeah.
Huh?
So yeah, a lot of freelancers.
Freelance. They were freelancers. You know, let's put on a show. Let's stage a revolution. Let's build an army. And they'd all march off and grant each other all sorts of exciting titles. I forget how many people arguably were the supreme commanders of the Texas Army at one point, you know, or had rank, you know, granted by this committee or that committee. So anyway, they're hammering out a constitution and a Declaration of Independence, which is a day or two before the Alamo was actually stormed. And then Sam Houston gets the authority to create an army, and then word comes that the Alamo has fallen and everybody's been shot. And right about the same time, word comes that Goliad has surrendered and Santa Anna has arranged to shoot about 350 guys there, marched them out off into the woods a little bit and knocked them all off, except for one or two. I believe he spared the surgeons because he didn't have any in his army. He was clever. He had neither the surgeons nor clergy. So, you know, if you were wounded, you were seriously in trouble.
Yeah.
So anyway, this creates a great runaway as some settlers, you know, flee towards the U.S. border. And meanwhile, Sam Houston basically takes his little army and marches it, you know, out of the way, and gives about 2 weeks of drill. So Santana's chasing them up there, and they finally reach what is now the field of San Jacinto. And it looks like the revolution's over because they're, you know, just going to keep chasing them until they cross the border into the U.S. And Mexican army sort of rests on its laurels, spread all over. And Sam Houston turns up and attacks, and there's basically a lot of revenge takes place. Although not as much as people would say, since a huge number of Mexican troops are taking prisoners, some of whom end up joining the Texas Army. There's a number of interesting people who, in fact, one guy, I think, one Mexican soldier who's at the Alamo on the Mexican side ends up in the Texas Army and so on and so on and so on. It ends up in the Civil War on the Texas side in the Confederate Army, which is confusing enough. So anyway, Santa Anna's captured, and Sam Houston has a tough time keeping him alive because, you know, they want to lynch him. And, of course, Sam realizes that if Santa Anna is killed, then someone else becomes president of Mexico. But if we can work a deal, even the problem will keep it, he'll still be president of Mexico.
Right.
You know, so he cuts this deal. And, of course, the senior commander, Mexican commander in Texas is an Italian guy. He'd gone over, he'd joined the Spanish army like in 1890-something, you know, and ended up fighting the Mexican rebels, and then, you know, became a major general in the revolutionary in the Mexican army. And he had almost certainly been deliberately picked by Santa Anna for senior rank, because the guy had very little coup potential.
Uh-huh.
And he had no native roots.
Right.
So, you know, when he got ordered from Santa Anna to evacuate Mexico, he evacuated Mexico. He wrote an excellent book on the subject, by the way, which I believe is recent. Has been translated recently, about 10, 12 years ago. So now Texas is pretty much independent, although this continuous border war, in which the Texans don't do very well. From time to time, somebody gets the authority to go down and invade Mexico and annex portions, and they get knocked off as they cross the border down south and so on. And there's the famous story about this 12-year-old kid who basically beards Santana. You know, he challenges Santa Anna to not kill his older brother and his dad, and Santa Anna agrees to adopt him, and he becomes a civil engineer in Mexico, although he eventually joins Porfirio Diaz, not Porfirio Diaz, Juarez. Texas does something which is critically important. There's other secessionist movements like Yucatan, which Texas helps out, actually. But Texas gets French recognition. And this is very difficult for Mexico. The French have been trying to take over Mexico for a long time. I mean, they actually fought a war in the 1830s. There was some sort of a riot in Veracruz, and a French pastry cook's shop got ransacked, and the French intervened, ostensibly to collect damages, but actually, you know, probably to set up top. I mean, Napoleon III would have tried again 30 years later. So now that, you know, many Texans want annexation, I mean, many of the people who volunteered to go perceived that this was the, you know, prefatory to annexation. And President Jackson doesn't agree, and Martin Van Buren doesn't agree as well. And, of course, there's a lot of issues. Jackson is very sensitive to the sectional issues, and adding Texas to the mix would merely, you know, strengthen the South. Jackson was a slaveholder himself, but he was also an anti-secessionist. Through the Van Buren administration, this sort of festers, and then William Henry Harrison is elected for his 30-day term. And then John Tyler becomes president, and the anti-slavery faction in Tyler administration is not going to Tyler's a pro-slavery guy, but you know it's clear that they're not going to annex Texas then. And Polk comes to power, and considerable expansionism on the table here before 1945. Re-annex Texas, the phrase re-annex Texas. Because some American nationalists were arguing Texas was part of the Louisiana Purchase, should have been part of the Louisiana Purchase, although that's not accurate, since the Louisiana Purchase was the drainage basin of the Mississippi River, and Texas is not part of that. But, and now this brings us back to Mexico. Let's stay with Pope. So Pope, you know, basically annexes Texas. And, of course, this is going to precipitate war with Mexico. Now, on the other side, I've understood that there are Mexican nationalists who believe that the Louisiana Purchase is invalid. This gets really complicated. Louisiana is given to France, to Spain, at the end of the American Revolution. I'm sorry, at the end of the Seven Years' War. It's taken away from France. You know, England gets Canada. Spain gets Louisiana. And, of course, during the Revolutionary War, Spanish troops support the U.S. against the British. They capture Mobile, for example, which is technically part of Florida, which is a British colony. So then Napoleon comes along, and basically, around 1800, strong-arms Spain into giving Louisiana back to France in exchange for Tuscany. And frankly, in 1800, if you had a swap, Tuscany, I would pick Tuscany rather than Louisiana. I mean, you know, not knowing what the future was going to hold, you know, and whatnot. Technically, there was a condition that this was a square deal, and if Napoleon changed his mind, they were supposed to get it back. Well, Napoleon changed his mind, but sold it to the U.S. and then took Tuscany anyway from Spain. So there are some Mexican nationalists who don't want to deal with the U.S. And the U.S. is actually offering money for Texas too. The Texans are kind of happy about this because they realize they can't defend themselves against Mexico. If you could get a strong government in Mexico that has national support, Texas falls very rapidly. The trouble is that you keep getting a succession of coups and counter coups and the mini civil wars and, you know, regional secessions. San Antonio, for example, was occupied by Mexican troops several times. Just, you know, guys casually crossing the border and occupying San Antonio. So now you have the war between the U.S. and Mexico, and the U.S. wants to basically tell Mexico, look, we've annexed Texas, and let's make a deal, and we'll buy California. Well, Mexicans ain't going to do that, you know. So we get a war. And interestingly, President Polk is advised by Santana, who's living in exile in the U.S. And Santana basically tells him, capture Veracruz and march on Mexico City, which everybody thinks is insanity, except General Scott. General Scott thinks it's a good idea. Trouble is, General Scott's a Whig. The second-ranking general in the army is General Taylor. I'm talking about Winfield Scott, of course.
Right.
Zachary Taylor, who's a Democrat. Polk is a Democrat. So the initial operations in the war occur along the Rio Grande, but you're not going to defeat Mexico along the Rio. It was defeat a Mexican army or two. General Scott says, land the Veracruz, march on Mexico City, capture Mexico City, and then we can dictate peace to the Mexican government, not just defeat an army. So this goes back and forth for a while, but finally President Polk agrees. It's kind of interesting, the politics, the part of the war, that's so wonderful. Basically, I think there's 12 or 15 generals appointed, generals of volunteers appointed for the war, and something like 9 of them are Democrats. And of the 36, of 70 volunteer regiments raised for the war, 36 of them go to Democrats, and the rest of them go to, army guys. And the militia, of course, turns out to be totally useless because by the time they get to the border, their term of militia duty is almost up, and then they're ill-disciplined. And anyway, the volunteer regiments do great. Some of them very exciting experiences. The first New York, for example. Obviously, the states closest to Mexico got more troops into action. And several northern states raised relatively large number of troops, but they never saw service. New York raised 7 regiments, for example, and only 2 actually got into action. One of them ended up in California. It's really, really strange.
You have my own personal interest, which is the Mormon Battalion that marches all the way down there. The war's over by the time they get down there, but they're still under a commitment to the U.S. government, so they march him to California, and one of those guys is the guy that actually is involved in discovering the gold at Sutter's Mill.
Yeah, because they're discharged in California.
Right.
Yeah, they're actually, this of course is occurring more simultaneous with the Mormon movement to Utah.
Correct. So what they did was to fund the movement to Utah was they basically hired out all their able-bodied men to the U.S. government.
To the U.S. Army. Yeah.
And so a lot of the women, a lot of the people that crossed the plains at that point were women with their children with no men.
Right, yeah, or the eldest sons or one.
Right,
one
whatever, son. Yeah.
Yeah, and of course the Mormon Battalion has some very interesting people in it in terms of what's going to happen during the Civil War. Quite a number of them become notable.
Right.
Because they're officered by regular army guys. There's some really impressive marches around. I mean, the Mormon Battalion goes from, they're actually recruited across Illinois, Iowa.
Right.
And they depart, I think, from St. Joseph.
I think that's correct.
Yeah, and end up in California. Donovan, who's in, what the heck is he? He's an Illinois politician. Oh, anyway.
Right.
He's a militiaman. He takes a column that, goes down, I think it's the longest march in American history.
Yeah, because...
He ends up down in Chihuahua somewhere, and of course, he had been famous for, he had commanded the militia that put down the supposed Mormon insurrection and refused to execute the prisoners.
Correct.
Because, although he wasn't a Mormon, but he said, if there was an insurrection, it's over now, and therefore, extraordinary measures are not required. There's all this extraordinary stuff going on there.
We have the Civil War. General, a number of them on both sides of the Civil War participating in the Mexican-American War. We've got Grant down there. We've got Lee's down there, right, too?
Yeah, that's interesting. The contrasting experiences of the two men. commence the action. You know, so they're, you know, they're both tested under fire. But Lee serves the entire war as a staff officer. And he's an engineer. He does brilliantly. He's, you know, you would think, I mean, General Scott wins at Veracruz. It's the classic, it's an amphibious landing like we do in World War II. Like the Brits used to do in the 18th century. I mean, really brilliantly organized. You know, General Scott studied the British techniques, obviously. It's a very good book by David Surratt out about the British maritime logistics in the 18th century. I cannot now remember. Something in the Seven Years' War, it's called. But his last chapter, if you read it, you realize that they're conducting landings just like we did in the Second World War. Waves of boats hitting the beach, ships bombarding the beach, you know, this whole stuff.
Uh-huh.
And General Scott studied that, and they land on the beach. They capture Veracruz, minimal casualties, and he's got to do it in a hurry because the fever season comes in. And then they march inland. We are marching on an excellent road, but it goes through these mountains. There are repeated defiles and narrow passes and whatnot, which could be hell. And the Mexicans try to hold them, but Lee and several other engineers, including McClellan, are riding out there through the mountains, patrolling and discovering, you know, trails or creating trails that can be used to flank Mexican positions. And this happens again and again and again. But Lee actually has no experience of command, which I think is quite interesting. Grant spends the time as the quartermaster for the 4th Infantry Regiment.
Right.
So he's coaxing supplies over the mountains, having experience with bandits. In fact, he ended up owing the government $4,000 for years and years and years until finally when he was, I think after Shiloh, the government said, yeah, we'll forgive you, you know, because the bandits had plundered some money that he had, some government money that he had stashed and he couldn't account for it.
Right, and he ends up in several shootouts with the bandits.
Oh, yeah, he was part of the storming of Mexico City.
Right.
You know, because they would get into action, too. And, so several of these guys, Lee obviously learned the management of an army from Scott. McClellan obviously didn't, but that's a different story. But, yeah, there's flocks of guys on both sides. And, of course, in my column in North and South about a year or so ago, I ran a piece that a guy had sent to me. One volunteer regiment, the 1st Mississippi Rifles, and all these guys who came out of the regiments who later become famous in the Civil War. And it's the same for lots and lots of the volunteers. You get a lot of guys who, you know, during the Civil War, both sides are creating armies out of nothing. I mean, the U.S. Army was only 16,000 men at the start of the war. And then you get a couple of, you know, several hundred officers disappear, and there's never the full, you know, there's only about 14,000 guys actually in the army anyway of the 16,000. So the 16,000 guys, you know, big deal. You're creating huge armies, and you're drawing on who? The handful of regular officers that exist, about a quarter of whom, you know, join the South. Well, where do we address the officers? The answer is getting a lot of guys who'd done a turn in the Mexican War. Sometimes they were sergeants or lieutenants. Sometimes they're volunteer colonels. Sometimes they were incompetent generals. The South got a couple of those. Gideon Pillow, general, he was a Democrat, General Scott, called him, I forget what the exact quote was, but like he's most incompetent. He's a man who could not be trusted with the care of an army in the presence or the absence of the enemy, I think was the phrase he used. Now, that in one sense, that's like, well, if they're so incompetent, you know, what's the point? The other is that they can do the paperwork. And, you know, you need paperwork. And another issue is they can get people to join. They have a reputation.
Right.
So they get people to join.
Well, in fact, that's what Grant does in Illinois to start off the war, is they bring him on to act as a recruiter, correct?
Actually, to drill the drill troops.
Okay, to drill the recruits. That's right.
Yes, to drill the recruits. He's appointed a colonel at the state militia initially. Then he's given, I think, the 21st Illinois, which oddly had a colonel who was born in the South and had all these interesting adventures, had served in the Mexican War, and ended up settling in Illinois. And he turned out to be a drunk. In fact, he was such a drunk that he would like, you know, if he needed a drinking partner, he'd wander around camp until he found somebody on guard duty and just pull them off guard duty and they'd sit down and they'd drink. So Grant, of course, was not a drinker despite his reputation. So Grant got the job. And his experience in Mexico very quickly comes to the fore. If you really want some interesting stuff about Grant, read the early, you know, his early experiences in the Civil War. His regiment is ordered to Cairo, which is spelled Cairo but pronounced Cairo, they've got to march. You know, they've got to travel there, and so you know he refuses the use of a train. He wants to march the boys. And he explains, we better have a darn march sooner or later.
Right.
The hike. Let's do it in it rather than in Kentucky or Mississippi or Missouri. They'll also maybe have to contend with the enemy. And there's all these wonderful little things that clearly he learned in Mexico because he saw, you know, recruits basically being brought into the army and you know, suddenly they're sort of on-the-job training
and right.
Often under fire. So you can sort of see that in Grant's consistent attention to logistical arrangements.
Right. And that logistical experience has always proven critical for the most successful generals.
Yeah. You know, you can be good tactically. You can be brilliant tactically. But logistics and strategy are linked.
Right.
You know, you can be incompetent tactically. I mean, frankly, you know, most of us in the Second World War were not as good tactically as the Germans. Maybe in the last year of the war, you know, some American units were equally capable of standing up and duking it out with the German unit from the good old days, you know. But strategically, we had it down, and logistically, we were doing much better. I mean, yeah, our tank wasn't as good as their tank, but the point was our tank was only part of a massive operation and used very effectively in coordination, so they lost more tanks than we did.
Right.
Well,
we need to wrap this up, Al. I mean, one of the things where I want to sort of end here is, even after the Mexican War, do we continue to have border problems with the Mexicans?
Oh, yes, continuously. And, of course, there's other interesting issues, too. For example, we make the Gadsden Purchase. Mm-hmm. And that was basically done to permit the construction of a Southern Pacific Railroad. That was the initial purpose. But the Mexican government was willing to sell the land because they were broke. Several years, and of course, then there's adventurers trying to go down and export tobacco in various other places all over the world. You know, a bunch of guys landing on the beach to start a revolution is nothing new. And, you know, when Fidel Castro lands in Cuba, he's part of a long tradition and has nothing to do with whether you're a left winger or a right winger. It's, you know, adventurous. And there were these guys, you know, ended up like William Walker ends up being adobe walled in Nicaragua. In fact, it's interesting because standing next to him could have been Beauregard and Jefferson Davis. He tried to recruit them, and they thought better of the idea. But we also had a deal. At one point, Mexico attempted to sell under Juarez during the War of Reform. The Mexicans tried to sell us another chunk of North Mexico. But that was during the Buchanan administration, and Buchanan realized that this would really be a problem. You know, it's already difficult maintaining a balance between the states. If we annex northern Mexico, we're gonna have these new areas that would be, you know, just make things worse. And the boy was basically like, Mexicans like to say we stole a lot of land from Mexico. But, you know, maybe we stole it from Mexico, but the Indians claim we stole it from them.
Right.
And so did we steal it from the Mexicans who stole it from the Indians, or did we steal it directly from the Indians, or whatever, you know. Let them argue that out, and then we can settle other issues. The border was very porous. Many Indian nations, you know, did not recognize the border. There were informal agreements along the border. You know, you could sort of chase the Indians across, you know, but you know, pretend that you're not, you know. In fact, this is caught in at least one or two movies, you know, where Mexican troops and American troops sort of cooperating and chasing Indians. And then, of course, you get Mexican irredentists, the so-called Plan of San Diego, which is very difficult to figure out exactly what was going on, because the American reaction, especially along the border, a possible revolutionary conspiracy among some Mexican Americans and Mexican nationalists on the border, and it's put down, arguably it couldn't be like a lot of slave insurrections. They primarily in the imagination of the slave owners. And so, you know, some of this Mexican insurrection stuff may have been paranoia on the part of people living along the border. And the reaction was quite swift. I mean, people were jailed, people were shot, you know, just outright. And then, of course, you get Pancho Villa.
Right, and that's where we want to pick it up next time. We want to sort of, you know, so we've got up to that point, and so our listeners can expect next time that we talk next month that we're going to talk about Pancho Villa on up to modern times about the Mexican border.
Okay, very good.